From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. Rothschild man Emmanuel Macron is acting very much like a Rothschild man in terms of what he's saying. Minimum wage for Europe. For Europe, military alignment in Europe, fiscal taxation alignment in Europe. That's what the Rothschild man Macron wants. We know that in Merkel. Maybe not so much of that on today's programme. Anyway, hope you're well and you've had a good Tuesday thus far. You can tweet me at any time between now and the end of the show. As usual, it is at Richie Allen Show. Look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Welcome. It's just me and thee today. I do have two guests tomorrow, Wednesday, and two guests on Thursday. But today it's you and me going to round up the news, headlines, the big stories of the day, and put it kind of, well, we'll have our own unique analysis, you and I, of the stories. That's what we're doing today. It is the Richie Allen Show. It is live. It is brand new on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester and the usual places you can hear the programme, my website, triggerwarning.tv, and the TuneIn app as well. Is that music a bit loud? It might just be. I might just be going deaf. It's a possibility. Anyway, how are you? Tweet me. Tweet me. Email. It's so last century, isn't it? Email. You're best to tweet me during the programme if you want to get me. So I don't know how long I'll be with you today. It'll be an hour at the very least, maybe at the most, I've no idea. But I've plenty of things to share with you. So I do. Right. Yeah, Emmanuel Macron. The Empire fights back in the guise of Macron and Mrs. Merkel, as Nigel Farage constantly refers to her, Mrs. Merkel. The Empire is certainly fighting back. You might have heard Ollie Barrett on the news there saying that the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, of course, Conservative MP, has been in Brussels. When he got back from Brussels, or when he was leaving Brussels, the UK media jumped all over him, pounced on him and asked him, had the EU given any more concessions that might be useful to Theresa May? He wouldn't answer, because the answer is probably, well, no. No, they won't. They're not going to give any more concessions. There will be a delay. Article 50 will be suspended. We'll be told that it will be temporary. But you know what I'm going to say next? Because in this instance, anyway, I'm just totally and utterly predictable. I can't find any new way of saying it. We ain't going anywhere. By the way, don't panic. This isn't the beginning of a Brexit preamble. Very little Brexit stuff on the programme today. Just wanted to mention that the scare stories in the press, and today there are plenty of them, very funny scare stories right across the UK tabloid and broadsheet media. Apparently, the changes that will be forced on us, me and you, the great unwashed, will be catastrophic if we crash out. This is a wonderful term that the media has. You've been listening to me for a long time, many years, I know. So you will remember me giving boring lectures about the terminology and how the terminology is uniform right across the media. So they use crash out because it's very negative. Crash out of the European Union at the end of the month. Crash out. And if we do, we're screwed. You won't be able to get avocados. You won't be able to get bananas. So people who can't afford to buy vibrators are well and truly shafted. Or not well and truly shafted if they can't get bananas or avocados. We're being told this today. You know, if we crash out, no bananas, no avocados, and we'll have to start changing our diets, and there'll be disruption at the ports and all of that. No bananas. Yeah. Right, so here's a story that, to be fair to one or two of our media friends, or frenemies, or enemies, have been running with. And it's about Eurostar. Now, Eurostar has reported a record financial performance for 2018. And Eurostar has also said in the same breath, we don't expect any Brexit problems, no matter what, even if there's a no-deal scenario. Passengers, don't worry your little arses. There's going to be no problems in the event of a no-deal. And by the way, I have to repeat this, Eurostar said, record financial performance for 2018. Ah, dear listener, I want you to keep that in mind now. Hold on to that little fact, right? Keep it in mind. Record performance. The company distanced itself from a Department for Transport leaked memo, which warned last month, you might remember, that extra passport checks under a hard Brexit could cause queues of up to 15,000 people a day at King's Cross in London. They'll be queuing all the way out to Wembley. All that old fear-mongering old bollocks. So that's what they've been saying anyway. Brexit preparations are going really well, says Eurostar, and we expect, no matter what, to maintain services on the existing basis, timetable and terms and conditions. Now, the chief executive of Eurostar is a man called Mike Cooper, and he was on BBC Radio this morning, and the interviewer did everything she could to insinuate that Eurostar passengers would suffer in a no-deal Brexit scenario, despite his repeated assurances that they would not. This is interesting listening. Eurostar chief executive Mike Cooper, live on BBC Radio 5 with none other than Rachel Burden, one of our old friends in the media. Interesting.
So we're in a good position going into Brexit. I think 24 days and counting. Still work to be done, of course, but no, I'm reasonably confident.
Would it be better for you to have this resolved by the end of this month? Or would you prefer to see an extension in order to iron out the creases and go for a better deal, whatever that may be?
We're focused on the end of the month. As I say, we've got our safety certification in place. We've got operating licences in place. And we've got a resolution in terms of our e-gates in our station. So we're ticking off the list. And I think it helps give us focus, that the fact that we have this target of March the 29th. So we're in a strong position. Still work to be completed. No guarantees, clearly, because we're reliant on third parties. But people are engaging with us, and I'm impressed with the sense of determination to get a resolution and to keep the trains running.
Are you building in extra time for passport checks and customs checks?
She just won't let it go, will she, Rachel?
Checks.
At the moment, there's no change to the timetable. No, we're expecting to be able to process effectively. But clearly, you know...
If there was no deal, that would have to change, wouldn't it?
He's just said already, and he said earlier on, everything is hunky-dory, don't worry about it.
Well, we can flex. We're used to operating in uncertain times. You know, given the levels of communication we have with our customers, you know, we can advise people of any potential changes. But as it stands at the moment, the timetable stands. Sales are good. You know, if I look at sales post-March 29th this year and compare it to 12 months ago, we're actually well ahead of the game.
So that's interesting.
The consumer doesn't seem to be freaked.
The consumer doesn't seem to be freaked. That's interesting, says Rachel Burden. He said the sales are good. Keep it in mind. She's not giving up, this presenter. No matter what he says, she's not giving up.
What advice would you give then to people travelling post-March the 29th? And clearly that date may shift, but let's go with that for the moment. Do they need to build in extra time to their itinerary? Will they need to bring any extra paperwork with them? And so on.
He's just fucking told you no, you daft bint. How many other ways can he find to tell you? No, it's all going to be fine, love.
Stay close to Eurostar.com and we'll keep people advised.
Yeah, and you can't say for certain at the moment. That's the bottom line.
There can be no certainties at the moment, but we're in a strong position given the plans that we have, and given the sense of engagement that we've seen as well from London, from Paris, from Brussels, from the governments there, and also from the European Commission.
Right, she's going to talk now about the Financial Times, which ran a piece which said, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, passengers travelling on the Eurostar were going to be well, faced with horrifying queues and checks and all the rest of it. So she's going to mention this.
I am cited a confidential assessment drawn up by the government, which warned of long queues at London St Pancras International Station if there was a no-deal Brexit and a potentially a 40 to 60% reduction in Eurostar services if there was no deal.
Extremely misleading. It worked on quite a naive assumption, I think, that neither Eurostar nor the governments would undertake any action to mitigate that impact.
Fantastic. Totally misleading article, which was based on the assumption that we would sit on our hands, or we would twiddle our thumbs, or we would play conkers and do sod all while all of this was happening. It's thoroughly debunked, that claim by the Financial Times, that you've got chaos at the ports and at the Eurostar check-ins. He's just wiping her out here.
We've got robust contingency plans in place, and that's simply therefore not the case.
Yeah. Okay.
So she doesn't believe him, though.
Okay. So it sounds like you're not having any sleepless nights at all. You're perfectly happy with how everything's going.
She catches on fairly quickly, eh?
Perfectly happy by any means. You know, when you transport, getting on for a million customers across borders every single month, it's clearly meat and drink in terms of the business to us. And no, I'm not. We've got to be, there's work still to be done. We've got to remain attentive, we've got to keep people engaged, keep people focused and keep people targeted on March the 29th.
Good man, Mike Cooper, the chief executive of Eurostar. Now, it's interesting that, right, in light of the scare stories about the madness that we'll be plunged into, this post-apocalyptic world that will be our reality on the 1st of April, ironically, right? So that's interesting. What's also interesting is Eurostar announcing its results for 2018 because they are stellar. They said the results go a long way to suggesting that there have been no adverse effects from the so-called Brexit-related uncertainty. Eurostar said today that record sales revenues, and passenger numbers were underpinned by a buoyant business travel market, up 12% across the board for them. They said strong US traveller numbers and the launch of new services between London and Amsterdam, which had seen over 250,000 bookings since last April. I want you to keep record sales and I want you to keep new services in mind, Eurostar. Some of my more loyal listeners will know exactly where I'm going with this, because this time last year I bored the absolute bejesus out of you talking about this issue. Right. So, back in 2015, the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, a man called George Osborne, sold the UK's stake in Eurostar for 757 million quid. This is back in 2015. Forget last January. I'll tell you about last January in a minute. So back in 2015, he put the Eurostar shares owned by the taxpayer here on the market and sold them to a hedge fund for 757 million quid. If you think back to then, I kicked off about this for weeks. I never stopped shouting about it, kicking off about it, crying about it, to the point that I was getting genuine emails from people, including people in the business of making radio programmes, who were saying to me, "You've got to let it go, Richie. It's repetitive. You're starting to bore yourself now." And I agreed. So I stopped. 757 million. Why did I kick off then? Because it was wholesale fraud and criminality by George Osborne. Because all the advice given to him at the time and to the Treasury was not to do it. That £757 million was a drop in the ocean of its real value then in 2015, but also in the value it would reach further down the line because of growth in that sector and because of future new services. Future new routes around Europe. He was told not to do it. He was advised by everybody not to do it. Every financial expert, not only in politics, but outside politics and in academia, said this is borderline insanity to sell the UK stake in it. The Shadow Transport Secretary at the time, Lillian Greenwood, said it was unacceptable and that the taxpayer would never recoup the investment. Mick Cash, the General Secretary of the RMT Union, said, however you dress this up, the fire sale of the UK's Eurostar stake before the election has cost the taxpayer billions in wasted investment and lost future profits. Sold off to a hedge fund. It could be making money for the Treasury today. Annual dividend, etc. It's gone forever. I submit to you that George Osborne was, is and always will be filthy. That stunk to high heaven. And at the time, you know, Labour shadow ministers bitched about it and demanded an inquiry into it. But they only did for a few days and then they went very quiet. George Osborne is filthy. And I'm talking about last year, because this is going to be in the news again in the next few weeks. It isn't today, but it will be in the next few weeks. Remember last year, back in January, when I went on and on and on and on and bored you and made you cry because I wouldn't shut up about Carillion. Do you remember that? The massive scandal this time last year about the construction firm Carillion, which was getting government contracts, and how for 2 years the government was giving contracts to Carillion even though it was known that Carillion was finished. The public didn't know. The public hadn't a Scooby-Doo. But the government knew Carillion was screwed. It was absolutely finished. Profit warnings were being issued. Nobody else knew this, but they were still getting contracts from the government. Why is that relevant to Eurostar and to George Osborne? Well, giving contracts to a company that was going under. When those contracts were being issued, George Osborne was Chancellor of the Exchequer here in the UK. Now, when he left his job, when he was sacked, effectively, when Theresa May, after the referendum, the EU referendum, Cameron resigned, May took the throne, she put her own people in, and Osborne was gone. Osborne went to work for an investment firm called BlackRock after leaving his job as Chancellor. And they gave him £650,000 a year for working one day a week. Now, here's the kicker. While George Osborne was Chancellor, BlackRock was making bets that Carillion was fucked. BlackRock was short selling Carillion. They had inside information. While everybody else thought that Carillion was on the up and up, and while Joe Public was still buying worthless fucking shares in Carillion, BlackRock was short selling it and making a killing. And then after Osborne left the Treasury, he went to work for BlackRock. Any chance maybe that there's a connection there somewhere? Maybe the job with BlackRock was a payoff, maybe?
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. Nothing to see here, please.
Please disperse. And nobody yet has put a figure in terms of how much money the UK taxpayer has lost in the contracts and the money given to the construction firm Carillion for private finance initiatives and for other public projects. Nobody has a clue. Think about that, right? While the government was giving them money, we now know the government knew the company was going to fail. BlackRock was short-selling the Carillion stock and making hundreds of millions of dollars. Later on, Osborne went to work for BlackRock, £650,000 a year for guaranteed working one day a week. Put that with Eurostar and everything else. If it was me, if it was you, you'd be in prison now. You'd be in prison. And last year I sent a copy of a show which was deleted by YouTube. Not one of the shows that was deleted when they deleted the channel entirely, but the show was deleted after I sent the show to the Metropolitan Police and asked them to investigate George Osborne, who's now working for the Evening Standard as the editor of that paper. I suggested at the time that any fraud investigator worth his or her salt would want to turn George Osborne upside down by the ankles and shake him just to see what might come out. you know, 22 and a half minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show, live for Tuesday, March 5th, 2019. I'll tell you what, I'm going to take a tune now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Donald Trump and the Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and her comments about the Israeli influence on US politics. Very interesting story. We'll get right into it after some music from The Who. Why not The Who, eh? Yes, and you can keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Welcome to the programme. Great to be with you as always. Love this tune. It's Substitute. Music from The Who. Substitute on the Richie Allen Show Tuesday's programme. Thanks for joining me. Hi to Faisal, to Bass Ninja. Hi to Liz Jones. How you doing, Liz? David tweets, I'm building a bunker at the bottom of the garden. Is 60 feet deep enough? Oh no, no more German cuisine in Tesco, says David. Don't know about that. Hi to Maharg as well. And to Celia. How you doing, Celia? A lot of tweets coming in there. Forgive me. Got to scroll back through them. Hi to Paul Alawi. How you doing, Paul? Strong and Cable as well. A lot of comments on the George Osborne story there. Carillion, but of course Eurostar and its announcements of record profits last year. Profits which could be going into the Treasury coffers, but they won't be because it was sold by George Osborne for a song back in 2015, Criminality. Delroy tweets, Richie, the World Health Organization never did anything good, he says. Speaking about the WHO, I see where you're going with that, the WHO. Did speak a bit about the World Health Organization yesterday and plans to crack down on anti-vaccine information being put out in the UK online. I'm going to get into that in greater detail this week. I think it'll be on Thursday. Hi to Jason as well. A metal version of The Who's Substitute by a band called Great White. I remember a band called Great White. They were an 80s heavy metal band, weren't they, if I remember? I think they were. 27 and a half minutes past the hour. Time to move on. The US President Donald Trump has said Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's latest controversial comments about the US-Israel relationship represent a dark day for the Middle East country. It's a dark day for Israel, said Donald Trump, because Ilhan Omar, the Democratic Congresswoman, the first one from Somalia, which is not from Somalia, second generation, third generation. She's the first Somali American elected to Congress. She's been talking about the Israeli influence and she's been forced to defend herself when she tweeted about being pressured to pledge allegiance to Israel. I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country, she told an audience in Washington on Wednesday. She doubled down on her comments on Sunday, tweeting that she should not have allegiance or pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve in Congress. Late on Monday evening, Trump tweeted, Representative Ilhan Omar is again under fire for her terrible comments concerning Israel. Jewish groups have just sent a petition to Speaker Pelosi asking her to remove Omar from Foreign Relations Committee, a dark day for Israel, said puppet Trump. Yeah, what did she say? She wanted to talk about political influence in the US and being asked to pledge for Israel. She said on Monday, yesterday, I'm told every day that I am anti-American if I am not pro-Israel. I find that to be problematic. And I am not alone, she said. I just happen to be willing to speak up on it, and yet I find myself open to attacks. Last month, she apologised after facing widespread bipartisan condemnation for a tweet in which she said Jewish money was behind congressional support for Israel. Well, it is, of course, but she apologised inexplicably. So they're out to get her, which means she's probably a goner. The lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who you know all about, he's a rabid Zionist attack dog in New York. You'll remember his attempts to destroy Norman Finkelstein and have Norman's university tenure taken away from him, which he succeeded in doing, it must be said. Alan Dershowitz was rolled out by Fox News to condemn the Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Here is Dershowitz speaking with Fox last night.
Well, she is very anti-American. Put aside the anti-Israel. She's so anti-American. She accuses American members of Congress, men and women, Jewish, Christian, she accuses them, essentially, of doing it for the money. We know that Americans overwhelmingly support Israel because Israel is a democracy. It's America's strongest ally in the Middle East. It's the only country in the Middle East that America can always count on. You never know who's going to be the head of Egypt next month. Right. You never know what's going to happen in other countries. But you know that no matter who's elected in Israel, they're going to be very supportive of America. They're going to exchange intelligence information, military information. And her attack on supporters of Israel is an attack on America. And she accuses them of dual loyalty. Well, she supports Hamas.
By the way, before Dershowitz drones on, and I will let him drone on for a minute, if you're expecting the Fox News anchor to jump in and at least put the other side of it to Dershowitz and play devil's advocate in the absence of the congresswoman, don't hold your breath. He's not going to do that. This is a monologue by Dershowitz.
Hamas, she supports other terrorist groups that are anti-American. If supporters of Israel are guilty of dual loyalty, which they're not, what about supporters of America's enemies? So, you know, her arguments are absurd. They're down at bottom. They're anti-American. And, of course, they're anti-Israel, which is America's strongest ally. And I think the response in Congress has been appropriate to condemn her
right.
and to marginalize her.
Right, says the Fox News anchor. Did you hear him? Right.
It's her. And to make sure people understand, she didn't run on this platform. This is a bait and switch.
Hang on a second now, Dershowitz, you fucking bastard. She didn't run on the platform? Did Donald Trump run on the platform? Did he run on the platform to threaten the sovereign nation of Venezuela with military force? Did he? Maybe that's a bait and switch, maybe. Maybe your old bum chum Obama, maybe. Maybe he didn't run on the platform of bombing Syria, of destroying Libya, maybe. He didn't run on that platform. That's a bait and switch as well, you could argue.
Gotten in Congress now, and she's taken on herself to present the strongest anti-Israel case in modern history that any member of Congress has ever tried to present. And she's being rebuffed, except by the radicals in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party who are jumping to her support. Some of them just on free speech grounds, but others on the merits.
Well, she has gone back and forth with members of Congress from her own party over the last 72 hours. And in fact, there's a tweet from, I believe, yesterday where she tripled down on some of her comments. She said, our democracy is built on debate, Congressman. Here she is referring to Nita Lowey of New York. I should not have been expected to have allegiance, pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on committee. The people of the Fifth elected me to serve their interest. I am sure we agree on that.
All the Fox News guy had to do his job was say to Dershowitz, isn't she entitled to her opinion? If that's what she believes, she doesn't like the influence of the Zionist lobby in D.C. Isn't she entitled to her opinion without being threatened with being thrown off certain committees and being marginalised? That's all he had to do. Now, the pledge is very interesting. That's what Ilhan Omar tweeted. Why am I being asked to pledge support to Israel to serve on committees? Now, Dershowitz, lying pathologically, says that nobody has to sign any pledge or agree to support Israel. That's what he says next.
No, nobody has to take a pledge of intra of any kind of pledge to serve in Congress in the United States. But she told her constituents when she ran that she would support America, and she is not. Mm-hmm. She is supporting America's enemies and undercutting American values. You know, the fact that she supports enemies of America and doesn't look herself in the mirror and say, my God, if I'm accusing people of dual loyalty, where are my loyalties? Are my loyalties to America or are my loyalties to the Palestinian Authority, to Hamas, to Hezbollah? I'm not accusing her of dual loyalty. She has the right to express support for enemies of America. That's part of her a role as a free person in Congress. But for her to accuse Jewish members of Congress and non-Jewish members of Congress right. of dual loyalty because they support America's allies, would you accuse somebody of dual mm-hmm. loyalty if they supported England, if they supported France and other American allies? It's the worst canard, and it's right. it really goes back to some of the anti-Semitic tropes of the early 20th century and late 19th century, and she ought to be ashamed of herself.
They're not supporting Israel or Israel's right to be there. They're taking money vicariously through shell companies and fake organizations, which we're going to hear about in a minute. Organizations which are, in fact, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. They're taking that money in order to do, in return for promoting what Israel wants. And making sure that Israel gets what it wants from the United States government. It's not about supporting Israel at all. Do you want to know how it works? I did an interview 4 years ago with Cynthia McKinney. Two-term Georgia congresswoman. You'll know, of course, who she is. The first African-American woman to win a seat from Georgia. It was startling what she said to me 4 years ago. Not for me, because I'd been hearing this for years. But for the audience at the time, it was startling. Again, this was deleted by YouTube, but the whole interview is available on Podomatic even, and iTunes. It had been viewed on YouTube nearly 3 million times before it was deleted. That's how much traction it got, because for so many people, it was the first time they'd ever heard just how the Israeli lobby works in Washington, D.C. Here it is, Cynthia McKinney talking about what the Zionist lobby does to new congressmen and women in Washington, D.C. Just listen to this.
I tell you what was an eye-opener for me when during my very first campaign was the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, because I had never seen anything like what I experienced with them was sheer torture. What happened was I received the facts from them, and the facts said, it was like a pledge, and I needed to, you know, sign my name and send it back to them, and they would keep a record, you know, that you made this pledge that you were going to support Israel. And so it had some stipulations on there, you know, military superiority, aid, what else? Oh, Jerusalem was the capital city. And I said, I'm not even sworn in yet. Can you give me a chance to get involved, to get inside the system, learn the issue, and then I'll get back to you?
Common sense.
Common sense, maybe, but not political practice. I was hounded from that moment on, whether it was a women's organization or an environmental organization. What I learned was that the operatives for the Israeli lobby, they control women's organizations, environmental organizations. It really didn't matter what peace organizations, everything is a fraud. And so I would say, okay, I want to get your endorsement from the environmentalists or the women's organizations. And I would get a call saying, well, did you sign the pledge? Now, this ostensibly is from a women's organization. I'm a woman. I'm the only woman running.
Yeah.
And I needed to sign the pledge before I could even get looked at. Peace organization. You signed the pledge. Environmental organization. Oh, we can't support you. You didn't sign the pledge. What I learned, of course, I went through and did a whole lot of researching. And then I discovered that Gus Savage, member of Congress from Chicago, had also been targeted by them before my arrival. And he put his experience on the congressional record for the world to see if they, you know, would care to read about it. And what he said is what I discovered. And that is that every aspect of the political process is in some way or other controlled or influenced by people who are affiliated with the pro-Israel lobby. So the name of the organization might be the New Jersey Garden Club, but in actuality, it's them. And so what his experience was that his opponent was getting thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars from organizations like the Garden Club. That's an example that Gus Savage used. And he started investigating to say, well, why is the New Jersey Garden Club contributing money to my opponent in Chicago? And then he found the links.
Amazing, eh? So you've got benign sounding organizations like women's groups, peace groups, environmental groups, gardening societies, whatever, coming to brand new congressmen and women and offering support. And if you're on the left, I suppose, when a peace group or an environmental group comes to you, you're thinking, marvellous, this is good. They'll endorse me, they'll help me raise some very necessary funds or funding for future campaigns. But no, in reality, they are front groups for the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And what she was experiencing, she discovered that Gus Savage before her had experienced. Shocking, sinister in the extreme, the Israeli lobby. And for unmasking this herself and for going to bat against it, Cynthia McKinney ultimately paid the price, didn't she?
And that's what happened to me. I had people from all over the United States sending money to my opponent just at the word. And then we were able to come by a letter where the person who was soliciting funds for my opponent said she's not friendly to Israel. I had one person to write a letter. He was writing a letter all over Georgia. And that letter said, when we go to her office, we are received very well. And she always meets with her constituents. She votes very well on our issues. We have no complaint with her representation, except for Israel. And for that reason, this person was writing a letter saying, you know, for that reason, he wasn't going to support me and was asking the people who received the letter not to support me either.
What level of I'm struggling for the words here because it's extraordinary. This, how many men and women in the United States who take an interest in current affairs would know that goes on, Cynthia? I would guess it's very, very small.
It's very small. And that's why they are able to get away with it. So what I did was I went public. You know, I mean, I would have people call me up. Like I had this one guy, he's a comedian. He called me up and he said, I'd like to do a fundraiser for you. And we go 2-3 weeks into the planning and I think, wow, I'm going to have a fundraiser. And then they pop the question, did you sign the pledge? And I'd have to say, no, I didn't. And then they would hang up the phone, click up. And I got that over and over again. I had one event with Tipper Gore. We were already all the way into the plan.
Tipper Gore is the wife of Al Gore, who was Bill Clinton's vice president, ran for president himself, of course, famously, and lost, or didn't lose, to George W. Bush. And he's the guy who made the famous film about climate change, An Inconvenient Truth. So his wife was a pretty important power broker. and they were ready to do a fundraiser. Listen to Cynthia here.
All the way into the planning. And lady had offered to do, to host it at her house. We're all the way in, invitations in the mail, out, gone. And then she asked me, did you sign the pledge? So now I've got Tipper Gore coming to town. I've got invitations hitting the mail. And she tells me that I can't have the event at her house if I don't sign the pledge. That's the kind of stuff that I went through.
And there's a film called American Blackout, if you can get it. It might still be on YouTube. And it's a brilliant documentary about what the Israeli lobby did to Cynthia McKinney and how they scuppered her chances of winning a third term in Georgia. They destroy you, is what they do. Anybody who speaks about it is destroyed. That's what's happening to Ilhan Omar. That's what's happening to so many Labour Party activists and members in the UK, asking questions about the influence of the Israeli lobby in this country. You must be destroyed. Have a listen to Fox and Friends this morning. They ran a story about another new congresswoman, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. She's a New York Democrat, elected last month, and she's being accused of murky campaign finances. Listen to the clip. There isn't much substance in terms of what they're accusing her of. It's all very murky innuendo. Listen to Fox and Friends.
That's right. The story this morning alleges that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff ran a $1 million slush fund by diverting campaign cash to his own companies. We're learning this from a complaint from the National Legal and Policy Center.
There he is in the backdrop there, by the way.
Right. He's a psychiatric
or body.
Big fortune, Silicon Valley, and worked for Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign.
It is alleged that his companies appeared to have been set up for the sole purpose of obscuring how the political donations were used. And we've got a soundbite from Tom Anderson from the National League. And he says, I have never seen a more ambitious operation to circumvent reporting requirements. Representative Ocasio-Cortez.
Listen now, there's absolutely no substance. They came on the air with a big story. They were delighted. Ocasio-Cortez, there are questions about her funding and how she financed her campaign. And nothing they've said yet has any substance to it. It's all footsteps in the night and whispers and innuendo. Listen, it doesn't get any better.
Ocasio-Cortez has been quite vocal in condemning so-called dark money, but her own campaign went to great lengths to avoid the sunlight of disclosure.
That's the group that filed this complaint yesterday with the FEC. The reason for this is apparently, you know, you have the political action committees, mm-hmm. and he had two of those under his name. He established these two, and there was $885,000 in these PACs that was moved over to private companies, which he also controlled.
Right. It's all about disclosure. In PACs, you have to disclose money. But
there's nothing in this. Now, there might be something in it. I don't know. But listening to these guys, there's nothing in it.
LLC, a company that, unlike the PACs, is exempt from reporting all of his expenditures over $200. And this is way over $200. So Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah. Right. So she parked some money possibly in a company that isn't obliged to disclose its finances, all very murky. Do you know what's going on there? There's no such thing as coincidence in politics. Not only did Ocasio-Cortez speak out about Trump's finances and allegations about his funding, but before she was elected, she was very, very critical of the Israeli Defense Forces and their use of force against Palestinians participating in the border protests last year, right of return and all of that. She called it a massacre in a tweet. And when she did an interview with PBS, the public broadcasting service, last year, she said that not only is she a proponent of a two-state solution, but she called the Israeli presence in the Middle East an occupation of Palestine. So there's no coincidence that they're throwing mud at Ocasio-Cortez and her financing. At the same time, they're demanding that Ilhan Omar be burned at the stake for having the temerity to question Israeli influence on American public affairs. No coincidence. And in the New York Times today, in an article in the New York Times today, to the credit of the New York Times, a newspaper I wouldn't ordinarily have much time for, they write, today APAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, boasts 17 regional and satellite offices, a gleaming headquarters near the capital, and an annual budget so hefty that its chief executive earned more than $1 million in salary and benefits in 2016. Here's the kicker. Traveling to Israel on a trip financed by APAC is practically a rite of passage for freshman members of Congress. So if you're a new congressman and congresswoman, you'll be packed off for a holiday to Israel for a bit of re-education. In The Nation magazine recently, M.J. Rosenberg, a Jewish man who worked for APAC in the 1980s, said APAC's political operation is used precisely as Representative Ilhan Omar suggested, including during policy conferences when members gather in side rooms, nominally independent of the main event, to raise money and to decide which candidate will get what. It's exactly what Cynthia McKinney told me 4 years ago. Moving on. The chief police officer in the UK, the Met Police Chief Cressida Dick, has said that there is a link between falling police numbers and a rise in violent crime. This is after a spate of stabbings this year and last year. Two 17-year-olds killed in the last few days in London and Greater Manchester. Theresa May said that there isn't a link between dwindling police numbers and stabbings. Cressida Dick told LBC Radio this morning, in fact, there is a link. Here she is speaking with a guy called Nick Ferrari.
When Mrs. May says there is no link between austerity measures and cuts and the level of crime we're seeing, is she right?
I think if you went back in history, you would see examples of when police officer numbers have gone down and crime has not necessarily risen at exactly, you know, the same rate in the same way. But I think what we all agree on is that in the last few years, police officers' numbers have gone down a lot. There's been a lot of cuts in other public services. There's been more demand for policing, and therefore there must be some link. And I have consistently said that I agree that there is some link between violent crime on the streets, obviously, and police numbers. Of course, there is, and I think everybody would see that. That's why I asked the year before last to get more money and to have more officers, and was given a small amount. This last year, I've been given more. So what I'm doing at the moment is recruiting. And I'm recruiting 3,000 officers this year. Now, of course, it'll take a while to get them in, to get them trained and to get them experienced. But I absolutely agree and, again, have said we must have more officers on the streets of London.
So she must reverse her policy.
I don't want to talk about the Prime Minister. The Home Secretary has enabled people like my mayor in London to increase funding to the police latterly, and indeed has increased in some respects funding to the police in the last few months.
Yeah, she said she's on a recruitment drive there, but don't get excited. There's no job for you unless you are female, LGBT, black or Asian. If you're not, don't apply, because that's who they want. This was reported 3 weeks ago across the media. They're implying positive discrimination to make the force more diverse. It is absolutely crazy.
What kind of fuckery is this?
It's absolute fuckery. You give somebody the job and you put them into training based on their ability, not on what they look like, their religious belief, their colour or their sexual orientation. I think the police are being devastated to allow the privatisation of it. Military contractors and security firms will eventually run the police in the future. Watch the first 20 minutes of RoboCop. Seriously, it's seriously coming down the line. Destroy it in order to pave the way for privatisation after a public outcry. You know, children have been stabbed, and I can't imagine what their parents must go through. What do politicians do? Well, they cash in on this sort of thing and they exploit the grief of the families that are left to deal with the devastation. And we're going to hear a bit of world-class grandstanding now from none other than Fishwife-in-Chief Stella Creasy, the Labour MP at Westminster yesterday. This is a detestable woman. Listen to her carry on at Westminster, grandstanding and reading the names of people who have been stabbed in the UK of late. Listen to this.
Jodie Chesney, Charlotte Huggins, Tudor Siminov, Nedim Bilgin, Lajine Richards, Dennis Anderson, Alini Mendez, Simbozo Aretha Moola, Sarah Ashraf, Asma Begum, Camille Melzi, Bright Akinyele, Glendon Spence, Che Morrison, David Lopez Fernandez, Kamal Gibbardon Lynch, Brian Wieland, Jaden Moody. I'm not sure that that is a complete list of everyone who has been killed by a knife in London this year alone. But I can tell the Home Secretary that the task force, the consultations, the more reports isn't working. What on earth will it take for him to recognise this is an emergency that requires an emergency response?
Oh my God!
Won't somebody please think of the children?
George Burns once said, didn't he, the comedian, and I paraphrase, if you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. Creasy was trying to force tears from her eyes in her tirade yesterday and couldn't manage it. A thoroughly despicable character, but then that's what politicians do. They grandstand and they exploit the grief and the misery of others. Creasy, by the way, is the Muppet who wants to make misogyny a hate crime. She's a virtue signalling world champion, is Stella Creasy. That's about it. That's all I've got time for today. Tomorrow I'll be joined by Paul Craig Roberts and Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD. He will be with me tomorrow. And I will have two guests for you as well on Thursday. It's a shorter show today, but no less packed full of information and content today. I think you'll agree. It's been a busy old show and I've been at it all day. So yeah, two great guests tomorrow and I'm working on a show on Thursday, a special show dealing with a couple of issues, one being NHS England and vaccines, which is very, very important. And I also want to talk, I won't say because I want to get into it on Thursday. I've got a bit of preparation to do. That's pretty much it. Thanks for listening. The programme will be available on iTunes, Spotify and the usual places real soon. It'll also be on YouTube as well later on. Do share it when you see it. You look after yourselves and one another. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, March 5th. And we'll be back again live tomorrow, Wednesday at 5 p.m. I can't wait to talk to you then. All right. Thanks as always for being there. Until tomorrow, leaving you with the great Satchmo. This is Louis Armstrong.